Okay, thanks, Rui. Good morning, everybody. So I will indeed talk about tensor networks. I've been asked to make an introductory lecture on tensor networks for 1.5 hours, and that means compressing a lot of material. And instead of, I decided that instead of compressing a lot of material together, I would just take it easy and give you some ideas, a list of ideas, starting from zero, assuming no knowledge, and we'll see how far we get. These slides that I have, so when you want to discuss tensor networks, it's very hard to do it on the blackboard. If I have to draw this on the blackboard, it will take me 5 minutes. So what I did was my lecture will be based on slides, but you have those slides. You can access them online if you go to the workshop or the summer school webpage. And so don't stress too much about drawing everything. And the other comment is that, well, this is the outline of the lecture. We'll start with some general considerations. What are tensor networks? What type of computational requirements we're going to demand? What makes a tensor network useful computationally? We'll give examples in one dimension and in more than one special dimension. And then I'll focus in a little bit on a particular structure, MeRA, a particular tensor network that happens to be relevant to holography in one way or another. And this is the lecture today at now, 9 a.m. We'll have a problem session at 2:30, where some of the aspects that I will discuss will be considered in more detail. And then there will be a focus lecture by Marcus Hauru, 5 p.m., where he will work more details on MeRA. Okay? Very good. So I'll try to go slowly. Please slow me down if I forget. And also, please ask questions. This is supposed to be a lecture, not just a talk. So this is about getting some basic background clear. Okay? Let's get started. So, area law, you've seen the area law in many lectures over the last 2 weeks. And here, our starting point is also going to be the area law, but we're going to focus on another aspect of the area law. So perhaps, what's the area law? What we say is we have, say, a two-dimensional system. We have it in the ground state of some local Hamiltonian. When we look at the entanglement entropy of some region A of linear size L, what we see is that the entanglement entropy of on that region scales as the size of the boundary of the region, as opposed to what you would expect if this was a lattice system. And you pick up a generic state on this lattice system, then generically the entanglement would scale, the entanglement of the region would scale as the size of the region, not as the size of its boundary. Okay? So that's interesting. The area law has found applications, for instance, by studying the subleading corrections. Sometimes some of these subleading corrections are universal. Maybe they are related in a critical system. Maybe they are related to central charge, or in a topologically ordered system, they are related to the total quantum dimension. So there is some universal character to the subleading corrections. But here, we are not going to worry about those details. We're just going to focus on the fact that the leading order is not the same that you would have for a generic state. So what that tells us is that ground states, if this was the Hilbert space of this lattice model in two dimensions, a generic state lives somewhere in this Hilbert space. It turns out that the area law is for ground states is informing us that ground states are very special states. They are not generic states in the Hilbert space. So you may want to think of ground states of local Hamiltonians as living somewhere in some little corner of this huge Hilbert space. And that's an important idea that we will that will be actually a guiding principle to build tensor networks for ground states. Very good. So let's zoom in a little bit. We want to talk about many-body wave functions on n spins. Tensor networks will be a tool that we will use to describe efficiently wave functions. So suppose we have a lattice model with n sites. If we want to represent the generic state of these n sites, so let's say each site is described by spin 1/2 degree of freedom, so it can be spin up or down, then a generic wave function can be always expanded in a product basis where we say each spin 1 to n, whether it's up or down. And this will take, this will give us 2 to the n coefficient, and therefore we'll need to specify 2 to the n complex parameters in order to specify the wave function of n quantum spins. Okay? A generic wave function of n quantum spins requires specifying 2 to the n complex parameters. So, in this talk, we will discuss, in this lecture, I'll explain that this wave function, when we want to talk about ground states, when this wave function is the ground state of a local Hamiltonian, we'll find a complex way of writing it in terms of a tensor network. So I'm going to be using this type of notation, and let me take a minute to explain what this notation was, this diagrammatical notation means. So I'm using this in this lecture. Whenever you see a circle, you want to think that that's just representing a complex number, okay? And when you see a circle with a leg, that will be a set of complex numbers parameterized by one index. So a leg is an index, and so, for instance, in this case, this is a vector, right? It's a set of complex numbers parameterized by one index. It's a vector. If you see a circle with two legs, that's going to be a matrix. We have two indices. And more generally, if you see n legs, that's a tensor with n indices. And when I say tensor, I don't mean it in a GR sense. I don't mean it in the sense of having some covariant properties or anything. It's just a way of organizing an array with n indices, an array of complex numbers with n indices. Very good. So one more piece of basic details that are encoded in this graphical notation. If you see two circles connected by one index or more, well, now this circle for you is already some tensor. It has two legs, so it's a matrix. This tensor is a matrix as well, two indices. If you see that there is a shared index between, or a shared leg between those, just think, okay, there is a sum over that index, okay? So this thing here, you want to read it as the multiplication of two matrices. Okay, that's a matrix, they share an index, so that actually this is what it is. It's diagrammatical notation for the multiplication of two matrices. The result should be a matrix, and indeed, what we say is that when we multiply these two tensors, we obtain another tensor with two legs, it's a matrix, okay? So moving on, as another example, we have a circle that's a number, and on the other side of this equality, we have no open legs, so indeed that could be a number, but how do we get this number? Well, this is a vector. This is another vector, right? We see a circle with one index. And this guy in the middle is a matrix. So you want to think of this as multiplying a vector times a matrix times a vector. Okay? I hope this notation is clear, because that's the basis of everything that I'll explain. So at this time, I'll ask you a question. What is this? Sorry? Trace of matrices? That's the trace of four matrices, right? So of the product of four matrices. So indeed, that's what it is, okay? So is that clear to everybody? Any questions? Please. This notation you can put.
Please repeat the question.
Right, the question is how do we represent a complex conjugate in this notation? You'll have to put some star, or it will be understood by context. This notation is not complete. It just provides information about certain aspects of the operations you want to do. Question?
So these contraction operations are invariant under unitaries on the legs?
These contracted indices? The question is the question, are these contracted indices? Sorry, can you repeat the question? Which part could not be invariant under unitaries?
Well, it's like you're not complex conjugating. It's you're subtracting if you want two covariant
Again, these indices are not covariant or contravariant or anything. So we have to start from scratch here. We don't have the meaning of these indices. They are just labeling complex numbers. Right? We have a set, an array of complex numbers, and we organize them according to indices. And so in particular, for instance, here you have this multiplication. If you could define the action of unitary on the left or on the right, and here, if you define it as u x on this side and u dagger on the other side, then you know there is a consistent way of introducing the action of unitary transformations that will make this covariant. But this is an extra layer of detail that at this point we are not assuming. Okay? Any other question? Very good. So why do we care about this notation, or what's the point? The point of this notation is that if I want to multiply these four vectors with these four tensors in the middle in this way, I can always write it like this. But the first thing I'll have to do is they give me this expression is to figure out, okay, wait, A has three indices, maybe A is this guy. So A is connected with whom? Oh, with I, with X, J with B, K with C, okay. Well, this information is exactly the information that we have directly in this diagrammatical notation, okay? It's talking about the connectivity between the different pieces. All right? So let's go back to this expression. Let's try to read it now. Now we know all the elements that are necessary to interpret this equation, this equality. On the left-hand side, what we have is a tensor with supposedly n indices. Right, there are so assume that there are n indices here, and that's precisely a diagrammatical notation for these 2 to the n coefficients. Right, we said that we had some tensor or some that the 2 to the n coefficients could be labeled by specifying the spin up or down for each of the n spins, and so we have n indices that take each index taken to values. So the left hand side is clear, and on the right hand side, what we have is some other structure, which now we understand as the product or the multiplication, because there are shared indices, of a collection of tensors. Okay? So here, this is a tensor with three legs. It has one index which is open, or we are going to call this physical index, dangling index. And there are other indices which are connected to other tensors. We're going to call them bond indices. Okay? So the idea is that here we have single tensor with n legs, and here we have n tensors or some number of tensors with n open legs. So the number of open legs on the left and on the right are the same. Okay? But on the right-hand side, what we're using is many more tensors. So what's the point of doing that? Well, let's count parameters. We said that this tensor having n indices has a total of 2 to the n complex coefficients. And that is bad news for anybody who's trying to store these coefficients in a computer when n is large, because well, there is so much. You can buy the latest laptop. It's going to allow you to go to n maybe 30, 40, but no more. And in general, we might be interested in studying many body wave functions for, say, 100 spins, 1,000 spins, millions of spins. So this exponential increase is really bad news. On the other hand, on the right-hand side, what we have is this structure where we've put, in this case, n different tensors. And now if we assume, and this is an important assumption, if we assume that the bond indices of a tensor run over a number of values, say this index alpha runs from 1 to chi, where this chi, the number of values, does not depend on n, okay, it's fixed. It could be 1,000, a million, but it's fixed. Then what we have is that the number of parameters in this expression depends linearly in the number of sites or tensors. Okay, so what we are doing is we're replacing this single tensor which depends on exponentially many parameters with a product of tensors, each one with constant size. And we just put n tensors in this product. So if we do that, automatically we have that the number of parameters that we're using is only proportional to the number of tensors, which is proportional to the system size, okay? So on the left-hand side, we have exponentially many coefficients. On the right-hand side, we have a number of coefficients, which is only linear in n, okay? Inefficient, efficient. Okay, so, yes? I'm sorry, somebody closed the door at the end of your sentence. Can you repeat the sentence?
I mean, like this notation, does it mean the total state, or it just means one coefficient in a sum?
Okay, so what this says is we can completely specify this wave function by giving every time, so you have to specify the 2 to the n values of these indices, and then it's a complex number, right? Every time you specify a spin configuration of n spins, you get a complex number. So you can specify 2 to the n different spin configurations, so there are 2 to the n complex numbers. On this side, every time you specify a spin configuration, you get some number. You can specify again 2 to the n configuration, so you'll get 2 to the n complex numbers, but you can specify all the complex coefficients that you require here are not exponentially many, but just order n. Just think about how much you have to store in your computer. On the left-hand side, you have to store 2 to the n coefficients. On the right-hand side, you have to store n tensors, and each one takes, you know, 1,000 coefficients. So, okay? I'm sorry, I cannot hear. I'm really sorry, I still cannot hear you.
So the i's are from 0 to 1.
Right, up, down. Spin up, down, 0, 1, 1, 2, whatever, two values. They take two values. It could be spin 1/2 degree of freedom. Question? Okay, so you're asking how much chi would be for a particular situation? And that particular situation was? All right, this, my n here is the number of spins. Your SUN, it's a completely different n there. Is that right? It can never be worse. You can show that the chi, well, okay, it can never be. Worst case scenario, this decomposition, if this chi, for a generic wave function, this chi will may have to grow exponentially in n, and then you are back to where you started. But the point is that if you consider not, if you restrict your attention to a subset of such decompositions where chi is fixed to a number that is independent on the system size, then we are in the regime where we have an efficient representation. Okay? Yes?
How do you fix chi?
Let's say chi is fixed by hand, say chi is equal to 10. And now we have an efficient representation. Okay. I was worried that I would not have enough material, but now we won't have enough time, which is good. So what's happening here? Obviously, not all wave functions on the left-hand side can be represented in this way, right? You have exponentially many parameters here. How can you generically represent any wave function just using less than exponentially many parameters? Okay. Sorry, did you have a question?
I think you're
answering. Okay. So what's happening is this, that we have the full Hilbert space here, which is huge, it's exponentially large. A generic state is any point somewhere here. And tensor network states, once I restrict the bond dimension chi to say 10, or 1, or 2, or 3, it's going to just cover a small region of this Hilbert space. Okay? So indeed, we are not finding an efficient way of representing just any wave function, but just some submanifold. But you've seen a similar drawing just a moment ago, that had to do with ground states of local Hamiltonians, we said because they obey this area law, they are very special states. They are not generic states in the Hilbert space. Generic states in the Hilbert space obey a volume law for entanglement entropy. So we have a situation that, well, ground states, if our goal would be to efficiently represent ground states, and we, in principle, we don't know how to do that, but we see that they are special states. They, because of this area law, which is a non-generic behavior, because this area law of entanglement entropy, we realize ground states are very special. Very good. That's the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, as I just said, we can actually, if we can use tensor networks to represent, efficiently represent, some sub-manifold of states in the huge Hilbert space. And now the big hope, it's just a hope, is that the type of states that we can efficiently represent with tensor networks have something to do with ground states of local Hamiltonians. Okay? It doesn't follow from here that they are related, but the story will be, hopefully by the end of the talk, that actually we can use tensor networks, which allow us only to efficiently represent certain wave functions, to actually efficiently represent ground states. Okay? Questions? From a mathematical perspective, I mean, you have variational parameters in these tensors. You can change them, and then you see that they form some compact manifold. Okay. I'd like to repeat the question, but I couldn't hear it well.
I mean, like, could you explain what does alpha equal to 1 to chi at this
mean? Alpha?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm saying that we have indices, right? This is about tensors with indices, and an index is labeling options. And I'm saying let's consider this the index connecting these two tensors to label chi different options. 1, 2, 3, all the way to chi. So alpha is a name for the index, right? If this was a matrix, you could have a chi times chi matrix, and alpha would be labeling the rows, for instance, or the columns.
So is it like, I mean, if it is the number of tensors that get contracted between two things or something like that?
Can you repeat the question? So we have a sum over this index. Every time that we have an index shared by two tensors, there is a sum over that index. So in this case, this particular part of the tensor network is, or of the drawing is telling you there is a sum over this index connecting the two tensors. So this index is contracted. Okay? Question?
For a wave function with n indices, is the corresponding tensor network and the pictorial notation with n open legs unique? And if not, how do you decide how to organize this?
Oh, very good, very good. So I will be addressing this question through this talk. So there are many different ways in which you could decide to build your tensor network for the same wave function. Okay. Question?
It says independent of the Hamiltonian, right? Or it says some Hamiltonians where it doesn't work.
What part?
That you can simplify the whole setup such that you can always find a ground state using a tensor.
Okay, I haven't made the statement about we can always find an efficient representation in terms of a tensor network. I'm just saying that we are hoping that this will happen. And we will see, we'll get back to that later. Very good. So why do we use these Bond indices? Why do we need indices connecting the tensors? This is actually a question that one can answer. So suppose that we have a product state. So imagine that our state of n spins is just the product of individual states for each of the spins. Say you spin up, down, up, and so on. In that case, generically, what we can do, of course, is to expand the state of each spin. Maybe this spin, the first spin, is a linear combination of up and down, as given by this coefficient and so on. So the second spin the same. What we can do in this case is we can attempt this tensor network representation, but we end up with a very simple tensor network, because remember, this is just in order to characterize the state of the first spin, all we need to do is to give a vector of components, in this case just two complex numbers, and so that could be represented in this way. For the second spin, we have two complex numbers, a vector with with a single index that takes two values. So you can see that in the absence of entanglement, the previous tensor network is simplified to this. Okay? So in this case, we don't need indices connecting the tensors. Okay? So the conclusion is that the indices connecting the tensors are only required when there is correlations between the different parts of the system, when we have a state which is entangled. Okay? When we have an entangled state, when we have a state that cannot be written as the product of different parts, then the tensor network necessarily, if we want to represent this state with a tensor network, we'll have to connect the different tensors. Okay? So think about the Born index as accounting for correlations between the different parts of the wave function, of the spins. Okay? Good. So we've been already hearing questions about, well, how do you decide which tensor network you're going to use? Or are there different ways of, are there different tensor networks that we could use? And the answer is, sky's the limit. You can just use your imagination, put tensors together, and that's going to give you automatically, if you use tensors that have a constant number of coefficients, and you use a number of them which grows, say, polynomially in the number of spins, and you connect them together, then you have an efficient representation. Okay? So efficient representation is a statement about how many coefficients we need to use for in order to specify the tensor network. And usually that's just a statement about how many tensors we're going to be using. Another question that is, however, very important, at least if you are using this representation as the basis for some computational approach, is that you also want to be able to efficiently manipulate this tensor network. So it's not enough, at least for the purposes of this lecture, we are not interested in tensor networks where you can just efficiently specify the tensor network by giving a number of coefficients which is, say, polynomial in the system size, but we also want to be able to ask questions about this wave function. We want to ask how much is an expectation value, okay, for, say, a local observable. So that goes under efficient manipulation. We would like to have also an efficient manipulation, and it's not the same question. And let me illustrate this by giving you two examples of tensor networks. The first one is a matrix product state, and I've been already using it as an example before of a tensor network. And the second one is a quantum circuit, which I'll describe in a minute in more detail. And so here are two tensor networks. We'll see that both tensor networks give rise to an efficient representation in the sense that the number of coefficients required to specify the tensor networks is just a polynomial in the system size, in the number of spins. So we will have an efficient representation, and yet, in one case, we'll be able to efficiently extract information from it, compute the norm of the state or the expectation value of a local observable, whereas in the other case, we will not. Okay? So, and this is very important. When you think about tensor networks, it really depends on what you want them for, right, in the context of quantum gravity or of holography. You may just want to draw things, but there is also this other side, this other component, if you really want that to be the basis for some efficient algorithm to compute stuff, then you have to take into consideration whether you have an efficient way of manipulating the tensor network. Okay? Good. So let's have a look at these two examples. So matrix product state, it's just the example I've been using so far. We break the wave function into tensors that we organize in a one-dimensional array. Do we have an efficient representation? Well, I've already answered this. Yes, because if once we fix the bond dimension to be constant, so each tensor here has three indices. This one takes two values, up or down. This one takes chi values. This one takes chi values. So the total number of parameters in this tensor is 2 chi squared. If we fix chi to be 10, 100, that's a constant compared with respect to the system size. And so the total number of parameters is just proportional to the system size. Okay? What I'm saying is if I want to study 100 spins, I have the representation. If now I change my mind, I want to study 101 spins, I just add one extra tensor. I just add a constant number of parameters to the representation. Okay? But what about efficient computation? Can we efficiently manipulate this structure? For instance, let's compute the norm of this wave function. So to compute the norm of this wave function, if the branchette are represented by the tensor network, this scalar product will be of this form, where down here we've taken the complex conjugate, but as mentioned before, that's not important. I mean, that will not be, this is not something we keep track of in this discussion. So how do we, you know, here we see there are no open legs, so this is a number. It's a complex, some number, okay? But how do we compute this number? That's the question we need to answer. And how expensive is it to do that? And it turns out that in this case, what we can do is start, say, from the left, multiply these two tensors together. Multiplying these two tensors together will have some cost, which will be proportional to how many bond indices it will be related to how many bond indices are involved. So for instance, in this case, we're involving this bond index and this, right? You can ignore the rest of the network. We just focus on these two tensors. If you want to multiply them together, that will be some, it will have some cost, which happens to be the second power of the bond dimension. So some finite cost. After that, these two tensors are just the red one, and we proceed to multiply the red tensor with another tensor. And then the result we denote it with the red tensor, which we now multiply with this one, and so on. What you see is two things. The first one is that in all these manipulations, we never created a big tensor as an intermediate step. We are always using these red tensors have at most three legs. Okay? So we are not growing, we're not producing a big structure in the process. This is one observation. The second observation is that by the time we are done here, we're in an identical situation. So you know, there are still many tensors to this side. But we're locally, this looks exactly as where we were here. So the way to contract all this tensor network is by proceeding from the left to the right and sequentially applying these steps. It will allow us to move in this direction. So what I'm saying in the end is that it's possible to multiply all these tensors together by progressing from left to right and never building any big object in the process. The problem if we had to build a big object in the process is that the computational cost would explode. But that's not happening. And so in the end, we have to repeat this process, which has some cost chi to the third power. Okay, we have to repeat it n times. And we are done. And so the cost is proportional to the system size times some overhead. Okay? It's just linear. The cost of computing the norm of this wave function is linear in the system size. Okay? Questions? Good. So this is good news. We can compute the norm of the wave function. But of course, we want to compute more than just the norm of the wave function. We may want to compute the expectation value of sigma z acting on the site 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, on site 8, right? So what's the tensor network representation for this expectation value? Well, we have the ket, psi, we have the bra, and in the middle, we insert sigma z on site 8, okay? So in order to answer this question, what's the this expectation value, we would have to contract this tensor network. Now, this may look like sufficiently different from the previous case, but actually, if in the first step we just multiply these two tensors together, right? If we multiply these two tensors together, then we can then we just end up with a tensor network that, at least as far as the connectivity of tensors is concerned, looks exactly the same as the previous one. Okay, so the expectation value of this local observable can be computed by first absorbing this operator, this matrix, into this tensor, and then proceeding as we explained for the norm. So again, we have that the computational time is order n times some power of the bond dimension. Right? So this is great. With this wave function, we can represent efficiently, with this tensor network, we can represent efficiently wave functions on very large systems, and we can extract information from this wave function also, all efficiently. Okay? Very good. So, quantum circuit. Now, for the quantum circuit, we'll see that, again, we have an efficient representation, but this time we don't know how to efficiently extract information from it. So, in this case, what's the quantum circuit? Well, just imagine that you have initially a number of spins which are in state zero, and you apply a sequence of two spin or two qubit gates to them, as described here. So you imagine this is time, okay? And first we have a row of two body gates or two qubit gates, and then a second row and so on. And we're going to assume that we have the number of rows of gates or the depth of the quantum circuit is polynomial in n. So this really could be a set of instructions to tell experimentalists go and start with this unentangled qubits and apply these gates, right? But here we don't take this as some set of instructions for an experiment or for an actual quantum computation, but just as a way of efficiently encoding the resulting wave function. So what I'm saying is that if we have a number of gates which is only polynomial in the number of spins, so we will have then an efficient representation. Because, well, how many parameters go into one of these gates? It has four indices, right? It's a two-qubit gate. It has a number of parameters, which is it's a four times four complex matrix. And so it has on the order of 2^4 parameters. It's constant. It's independent of the system size. And now what we're saying is that we're going to put together how many gates? Well, roughly speaking, there will be order n times t, so order n times t gates, which is still polynomial in n. So all I'm saying is, in order to specify polynomially poly n gates, you need poly n parameters, right? So we have an efficient representation. What we're saying is, if you give me your favorite quantum circuit, quantum computation, we have an efficient representation of the quantum computation. That's how we're going to implement it in a lab, by following these instructions. But do we have an efficient way of extracting information from it? Not classically, right? Can we efficiently just take this description and now compute things with it? And luckily for quantum computers, the answer is no. So let's look at the norm, and let's look at the expectation value of some local observable. Let's look at the norm first. This is the norm. It's we prepare the state, psi, we prepare the brand, the ket. Now, if this is U, this is U daga. If this is a gate U, this is gate U daga, right? There was complex conjugation and so on. So, but it's a quantum circuit, U daga. These are gates, unitary gates, so they give rise to the identity, and therefore all the gates cancel with each other. Okay? And so when you try to compute the norm of this state, you say, oh, actually, I know how to do it. It's one. Okay? I was just unitarily evolving a normalized vector that I started from. So the norm is one. So no problem. We know how to compute the norm for this tensor network. But the question is, can we also compute the expectation value of a local observable? Let's try that. Here what we have is, again, this is the wave function. This is ket, the ket. we introduce sigma z or x this time somewhere, and then we have the bra. So this is a number, and we would like to be able to compute this number. This time, we still have many cancellations. If this is some gate U, this is U dagger, so they go away. And they go away in many, many places. But they don't go away everywhere because this gate cannot be canceled with this one. There is an obstruction in the middle, right? This rule cannot be applied. There is this insertion here. That means that there is some subset of gates that are left there. So let's clean this up. This zero scalar product with zero gives you a one, so we can take it out. We can take all the zeros away, and we're left with this structure. And now the problem is that we don't know how to efficiently contract this structure. So this structure has our depth. So we are left with T, T being poly N, T different rows of tensors, and up here we get, therefore, also T. So this is a tensor network in two dimensions of size T times T, roughly speaking. And it is known that there is no way to efficiently contract this object, okay? That the cost of contracting this object, a T times T two-dimensional tensor network, is exponential in T, okay? I mean, let me claim that. I'm not showing that to you, but it is known that that cannot be contracted efficiently. So that's the end of the story. We have an efficient, in this second case, we have an efficient representation, but we cannot efficiently manipulate it. So what's the point of efficiently, you know, getting efficient representation of states if you cannot say anything about them, right? It's not going to be useful, at least from a computational perspective. Questions? So it's exponential in t?
Yeah, but then why the right-hand side?
Oh, I was saying all the time t is some power of n. It's polynomial in n, just by construction. So indeed, if you decide that, oh, I'm going to consider a quantum circuit of constant depth, if t is not growing with n, then this thing here is going to be constant size, and then we'll have an efficient representation. So finite depth, constant depth, quantum circuits give rise to both an efficient representation and we can efficiently manipulate them. Good. All right. So this discussion was about, you know, telling you from a computational perspective what type of questions you should ask before you decide that you want to use a tensor network. Efficient representation, but also efficient manipulation. And now I'm going to give you examples of tensor networks that we've been using for the last 10 years that offer precisely this, the possibility of having an efficient representation and an efficient computation. So I've been talking about matrix product state, and now I would like to talk about the multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz. The first thing I want to say is that these two tensor networks that I have here, they are both targeting ground states of one-dimensional systems. Okay? So even though you see that this is a one-dimensional structure and this is two-dimensional, the goal for those tensor networks is the same, is to represent ground states of one-dimensional systems, spin chains. Okay, and when we talk about meta, you may see representations like this or like that. There are different variations. The difference in particular in this case is that we have that these tensors here take three legs into one, whereas these tensors here take two legs into one, right? So 3-to-1 versus 2-to-1. These are minor details. You could have 4-to-1. There are many variations you can play with. The computational cost will depend on that choice, but these are all efficiently manipulatable tensor networks. So I may switch from one description to the other in order to illustrate certain properties because it's just more convenient, but it's not no big deal. So I want to talk about efficient representation. We've seen the matrix product state, but I would like to see in which sense we have an efficient representation here. So for the matrix product state, the argument was very simple. For the third time today, we have n sites. We use n tensors. Each tensor has finite size, number of parameters. Therefore, the total number of parameters is just proportional to the number of tensors. So what about multiscale and time? What about the meta? Well, in meta, we have n sites in this direction, and we have log n rows of tensors, okay? So n sites, but we have this extra dimension, so maybe your guess would be that we have n log n tensors, and just to make it more communicative, I'm going to ask you, how many tensors do you see here? Is it n log n? Like the silence. So I'm not going to go on until somebody answers. How many tensors do you see? Marcus? No. Okay, so here's a hint. We can count them. The first double row, you see that roughly speaking, there is a tensor per site, right? So this gives us n tensors. The second row, we have divided, you see that there are half of the number of legs we started from, so there are n over 2 tensors. The third row, there are n over 4 tensors, all the way to until we are done. And so what we see is that even though we have log n double rows of tensors, the contributions, the number of tensors that we have changes, and when they are all proportional to n, but with a factor 1/2, 1/4, and so on. And so when you count all of the tensors there, all the contributions, it's still proportional to just n. Okay? So we have n spins for a system of n spins for a lattice of n sites. We're still using n tensors, order n tensors. Okay? And so the number of parameters is going to be order n. Okay? Good. And now the big question, can we have an efficient manipulation? Can we efficiently compute the norm? Can we efficiently evaluate local expectation values? And this is my answer to you. Go to Marcus' lecture this afternoon, and he'll show you that yes, that you can still efficiently manipulate this tensor network, in spite of the fact that I just said before that in a two-dimensional tensor network, we wouldn't know how to do that efficiently. The structure of this, the way this tensor network has been built, is such that it still allows for an efficient manipulation, okay? Again, for details, just go to, if you are interested in the details, Marcus Haure will give a focus lecture on those. Okay, good. So now, so far I've been just talking about computational aspects. Can we efficiently represent, can we efficiently manipulate? But that doesn't tell us anything about the physics of these tensor networks. What type of wave functions are we representing? So now I would like to move to discuss that. We have this area law, and I said I would be using the area law for entanglement entropy as a guiding principle. So let's look first at one-dimensional systems, a spin chain, quantum spin chain. Okay, that was the wrong button. Oh. It was reversible, good. In one system, in one dimension, what we have is that the area law is telling us that if you have an interval of size L, the entanglement entropy of the ground state on that interval will not depend on L. It's L to the zero. It's a constant, right? So area law in one dimension is entropy constant. And that's actually what we know that happens for gap Hamiltonians. So if you're Hamiltonian, we have a Hamiltonian for which we want to talk about the ground state. If this Hamiltonian has an energy gap, then we know in practice that there is this area law. And we also know that correlations in the system decay as a power exponentially with the distance. So that on this ground state, if you look at the correlation between this point and that point, this correlator is exponentially suppressed with the distance between the two points. So I'm just going to take these two known facts about ground states of gap systems in one dimension. And I'm going to try to remember those. In one dimension, though, we can also have another behavior. We can have a logarithmic correction to the area law. This will happen for ground states of critical systems. Okay? So for gap Hamiltonians, we had an area law. For gapless Hamiltonians, the ground state does not obey the area law. It has a logarithmic correction to it. So the entropy grows logarithmically in L. And in that case, what we also know is that a two-point correlator will be suppressed only as a power law with a distance between the 2 points. Okay? So that's my cartoonish characterization of ground states in 1D. I distinguish between gap Hamiltonians and gapless Hamiltonians. We have area law, strict area law, logarithmic violation of the area law. We have exponential decay of correlations or power law decay of correlations. Now what I'm going to do is I want to study properties of a matrix product state and of a multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz. And we'll see that there is a relation between the structural properties, say decay of correlations and scaling of entanglement in these tensor networks, and what happens in ground states of one-dimensional systems. So let's start with a matrix product state. And I want to compute a two-point correlator in a matrix product state. And you know, we can agree that the tensor network that describes this two-point correlator looks like this. Again, we have the ket for psi, the bra for psi, and I insert now two operators, two matrices, in two locations corresponding to the two spins. At location, I'm going to call this location 0, I'm going to call this location L. Okay? So this is a tensor network representation of this two-point correlator. Is that clear? Any questions about that? Oh, that's a question about here?
Yeah,
yeah, that's a very poor way of saying that this tensor is connected with this one. Yeah, so there are, good. Thanks for the question. There are periodic boundary conditions if we were describing a system on a circle, right? If the spins were, if this spin was nearest neighbor with this one, then we would connect the tensors in this way. Yes. Okay. So we have this situation here where we want to evaluate this two-point correlator. And now what I'm going to assume, well, we can contract all these tensors into some tensor here, all that, those tensors into some tensor there. So this evaluation, the first step is to reduce this tensor network to this one. Okay? And now I'm going to assume that I'm describing a translation invariant ground state. And therefore, all these tensors that you see here are just copies of the same tensor. Okay, all the variational parameters in one tensor are identical to the next one, and so on. I'm going to assume that that's a valid description for a translation invariant wave function, and it happens to be. And in that case, what we can see is that this two-point correlator reduces to multiplying. You know, you have some structure here which is repeated. These two tensors, are being multiplied by themselves. And L minus 1 times, right? This is psi 0, this is psi L. So there are L minus 1 repetitions of the same transfer matrix structure. So what I'm saying in the end is that this correlator reduces to something that looks like take a matrix, take the L minus 1 power of it, okay, and evaluate some left and right vector to it. So when we do that, if we can, there will be some eigenvector, eigenvalue of this matrix that is being picked up, some dominant eigenvalue, let's call it lambda, and L minus 1 or L are about the same. And so what I'm saying is that this thing scales basically as this eigenvalue to the Lth power. Okay? And that's already enough to see that that this correlator will be suppressed exponentially in L. Right? You have, when you have L sides away, there will be some this lambda to the L power. If you go one side farther away, there will be this lambda to the L plus 1 and so on. So as you consider these two insertions to be more and more separated, it will pick up extra powers of this eigenvalue. And so we'll have an exponential suppression of correlations. What I'm saying is that the matrix product states, before I even optimize the variational parameters, okay, I didn't optimize the variational parameters. I didn't try to approximate any ground state. I'm just saying if I choose a translation invariant matrix product state, MPS, then at least at long distances, the correlators will decay exponentially with the distance. Question?
So is it clear before solving this variational problem that these lambdas are smaller than one?
It is. By no,
smaller than one?
Right. So so the question indeed is whether this is, can we show that this is decaying with the distance as opposed to exploding with the distance? And it turns out that you can show that. You can show that once you've normalized this wave function, so if the norm is one, then the rest of eigenvalues of this transfer matrix cannot be larger in modulus than one. So all the correlations are guaranteed to decay as opposed to grow. Yes. Question? So, okay, very good. So the question is whether we should count contributions from all these left and right. So I just said here that we just put them together into a vector, into some vector, what I'm calling a vector, and another vector in the left and in the right. And the idea here is that these guys will come with eigenvalue 1, and if you have normalized the wave function. Okay, so imagine that these insertions are trivial. If you've normalized the wave function, then the eigenvalue that's going to be picked up is precisely a 1 to the L, right? Otherwise, you would not have norm 1. So that's a very good question, but the answer is normalization takes care of that. So the eigenvalue, this two-point correlator, once you've normalized the matrix product state, the MPS, this two-point correlator is going to be the only things that you need to worry is the scaling of the eigenvalue that's been picked up between these two insertions. Any other question?
Okay, I have a question.
Oh.
So I was curious to know, so you have this manifold of wave functions, and yes, then you have this region which is supposed to represent the actual ground state wave function, and then you have this space parameterized by this matrix product representation, and the expectation is that they overlap somehow. And I want to understand how to quantify this. For example, in this case, so for some particular local operator, you have this scaling dimension L, and so that's so C, so I guess correlation length C. But you can have different operators. For example, in this presentation, you can represent that operator in different way. For example, you can have different operator red, or you can, since this is a local operator, this can be, this may be making use of several of these bond to make operators. But then this bond matrix has chi indices to it. So it looks to me that you'd need to prepare at least as many chi's as the number of local operators that you want to describe. Is that the kind of things you need to do? What is the expectation that the overlap of these two subspaces are good?
Okay, so the first observation is that we don't have scaling dimensions here in the sense this is exponential decay of correlations. So we have correlation lengths,
yes,
right? And so indeed, this transfer matrix here, let's look at what's the dimension of this matrix. This is the bond dimension, chi. So it's chi square times chi square. So this is a chi square times chi square matrix. How many eigenvalues can we have? Chi square eigenvalues. So this matrix is only capable of representing chi square different correlation lengths. Okay, so that sets a limit to how accurate this description is going to be.
And are there some other evidences that this overlap of the two spaces are good? The overlap.
I haven't introduced any. Oh, okay. This is leading towards some evidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the first step. Yes, I will.
You'll be talking about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Very good. So, and in the problem session, you'll be asked to reproduce this argument. So, you'll have a chance to think about it a bit more. So we have this exponential decay of correlation just coming from the way we've connected the tensors together. What about the mirror? Well, Marcus will give us details on that at 5 p.m. But the calculation there looks a bit more complicated. Again, we have the cat up here, the bra. We put the two insertions. And now there are many details involved in this. And you, if you're interested, just go to the focus lecture. But the idea is that this is a unitary that can annihilate with, if this is you, this is you dagger. There are some relations here that allow us to simplify this tensor network into this one. This is an equality. Okay? This tensor network is, there are constraints on these tensors that allow us to remove them everywhere except near the insertions. Okay? And we end up with this tensor network. Now, let me mention that here, if there are L, if the distance is again L between these two insertions, there will be, we'll be left with log L different layers that contribute to this calculation. And if we stretch the representation, this is equal to that, just I take the two insertions and stretch them a little bit. Then what we see is that again we have some form of transfer matrix problem where we have a left vector, a right vector, and some copies of the same, assuming that all these tensors are the same at different scales, then we have this situation where this expectation value that we want to compute, this two-point correlator, results from taking some matrix and applying it log n times. Okay? So we pick up some eigenvalue, and we pick it up log L times, because there are all log L layers contributing. And if you do that, then you get this eigenvalue to the log of L. But there is this cute relation that x log y is equal to y log x. So lambda log L is the same as L log lambda. And there you have your power law decay. Okay? So the power law decay of correlations came automatically out of, in Mera, out of just assuming that the different layers in the mirror are equivalent, have the same tensors. We've chosen the variational parameters in different layers to be the same. Okay? That sounds like scale invariance if you choose the same different. So these different layers happen to represent different scales. If you choose those different layers to be the same, then that amounts to enforcing scale invariance. And what we see is that in this scale invariant meta, when generically, without even specifying what variational parameters we're going to choose, just assuming that they are the same at all layers, the two-point correlator obey power law decay, okay? Just as in critical ground states. More details this afternoon. So polynomial decay of correlations. Okay, so let's try to interpret this. We have two tensor networks for ground states of one-dimensional systems. And we've seen that the NPS gives you exponential decay, whereas the mirror gives you power law decay of correlations. Now, we could start thinking geometrically. We could start thinking that maybe these tensor networks are describing some geometry. In the matrix product state, the geometry of the tensor network is just reproducing the geometry of the underlying lattice. You have L sides, you just put the tensor on each side, right? So a one-dimensional geometry. The MPS uses a one-dimensional geometry to describe a one-dimensional system. Whereas the mirror, in some sense, uses a two-dimensional geometry to describe the ground state of a one-dimensional system. When I say geometry, of course, you have to be very tolerant here and think, okay, this is a discretized version of some geometry. Okay? And now what we can do is we can start thinking that the result of this power law decay, exponential decay or power law decay of correlations is just a result of understanding geodesics in this geometry. So in the case of the matrix product state, the distance between these two points separated by L sides within the tensor network remains L, proportional to L. Okay? So if you think that the correlations are exponential of minus the distance, there you have exponential of minus L. So exponential decay. Whereas in this case here, what we have is that we have somehow a discretized version of some two-dimensional geometry. And this two-dimensional geometry happens to be hyperbolic. And why do I say that? Well, I say that because it turns out that two spins separated by a distance L happens to be connected within the tensor network by a path of only length log L. I'm counting here how many tensors I have to go over. That defines my length, okay? It's all discrete, it's all just hand waving, but it's working. So what we see is that we can understand, again, the two-point correlator in the meta as being given by the exponential of minus the distance within the network. Okay, this distance now is logarithmic, so the exponential of a log gives you a some power. Okay, so we have a geometric interpretation of this behavior. And so the point here is that the way you connect the tensors to build your favorite tensor network matters, because it predetermines how, say, correlations are going to decay in the variational class. This is before we even optimize the variational parameters. Okay? And I want to stress that this is a statement about asymptotic decay of correlations. So at short distances, you can use the variational parameters to obtain different decays. As was mentioned before, you have actually, in the matrix product state, you have chi squared different length scales, or correlation length that you can play with. And so by a sum of chi squared different exponentials, you can approximate many functions at short distances. Okay? But the statement is that asymptotically at long distances, the way you've connected the tensors together predetermines how the correlations are going to decay. Okay? Very good. Let me check time. Okay, very good. Any questions? No, at long distances.
What was the question?
Oh, sorry. The question was, if we give up translation invariance in the MPS, can we then get away, can we do better than, or better, can we have correlations that decay slower than power law asymptotically at long distance? And the answer is no, because, you know, this assuming translation invariance gives you the transfer metrics to be the same everywhere. That's the most coherent way in which you can build correlations. If you start changing the correlation metrics, the correlations will decay faster than that. If you start changing these transfer metrics, you know, the dominant eigenvector is not going to coincide on one part with the next one, so you're going to lose with respect to that situation. So correlations will decay faster. Okay? Very good. So, entanglement entropy. So what we just saw is that the way you connect your tensors matters. We saw that asymptotic decay of correlations are predetermined by how you've connected the tensors into a tensor network. We saw exponential decay for matrix product state and power law decay of correlations for meta. Now, we can ask another question that is also answered by how we've connected the tensors together into a tensor network. And it's how entanglement entropy scales. And this, all this will be reviewed or re-asked in the problem session, also this afternoon. So for the matrix product state, we're going to look at what we have is that an upper bound to how much entropy you can have in a given region is given. Remember that the Born indices were responsible for correlations. Remember that if we didn't have the Born indices, we had the product state necessarily. So these Born indices actually are responsible for allowing correlations and entanglement in the wave function. So you can easily show, actually, that the amount of entropy that you can have in region A is upper bounded by the number of indices you have to cut in the tensor network to split the tensor network into two pieces, one containing the region of interest and the other the rest. So if I want to split the tensor network, the MPS, into two pieces, one containing the indices for part A and the rest, I have to cut two indices, okay? But two indices is a number that does not depend on L, on the size of the region. So every time I have this region, I can change the size of the region. Always two indices is all I have to cut in order to split the wave function. Okay, the tensor network into two pieces. And this automatically tells us that at most, the entropy of the region is some constant. It's right? It's given by, you know, 2. It's upper bounded by 2 times some factor. But we cut 2 indices. At most, we can have entropy, which is proportional to the number of indices that we cut. So we have an upper bound by a constant. OK? Questions? Yes? Yes. I just meant that here we have 2 tensor networks. We've connected the tensors, in this case, as a 1-dimensional array, in this case, as a 2-dimensional array, in 2 dimensions, sorry. And that made the difference. This guy can only asymptotically have exponential decay of correlations. This guy can only have power law. What exponents, what, this will depend on the variational parameters. Okay, so we have that the entropy carried or on a region of size L in the MPS is upper bounded by a constant. Okay? Because there, we can always split this region into 2 pieces by cutting just 2 indices. Whereas in Mera, what we see is that the number of indices that we have to cut in order to split region A from the rest depends on the size of region A. Okay? If I wanted to cut just these 2 spins, I just need to cut 2 indices. If I want to cut this region out, I need to cut more bond indices. If the region was larger, I would have to cut more and more indices. Okay? And how many? Well, it happens to be log L, how many indices I have to cut. It's, if the system has, if this region has size L, I need to go up log L steps before I can come down, right? And this really sounds like Ryo Takayanagi type of expressions where you are going to the bulk and look for extremal surfaces. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to split, to break the tensor network into 2 pieces by looking at whatever cut we find that contains the smallest number of bond indices that we need to cut, and so this has the sense of extremal in it. Very good. Yes.
I wanted to know whether this is an independent evidence that this is a good ansatz for wave function. I thought that one could prove that if you have exponential decay of correlation function, then entanglement entropy must have area law in 1+1 dimension. Isn't that? I'm asking whether these are logically independent evidence.
I don't know that these are logically independent. I'm just saying that here you have 2 structural properties mm-hmm. that follow from the way we've connected tensors. So they follow from the same origin. So maybe they are not independent. But I'm just trying to, you know, be pedagogical and illustrate clearly 2 properties that come out of this.
Thank you.
So they have the same origin. Mm-hmm. It's the same tensor network that gives rise to these 2 properties. Okay, so now we can go to our table. I'm going to build this table. I'm going to use it for a while. So we're in 1 dimension, and we have gap up systems, and we have gapless systems. What we said before, just by looking at the scaling of entropy, that we had an area law, which meant a constant, or maybe we have a logarithmic correction. And what we've seen is that we have a tensor network for both situations. For the case where we have constant entropy, the matrix product state reproduces this. So we've looked at ground states, we've looked at tensor networks, and we see a match, at least in these properties. Okay? The matrix product state happens to obey the area law. And we've seen also that the Mera obeys the scaling that we've seen in gapless systems. Okay? So there is a match between the type of ground state we find out there in 1 dimension and the type of tensor networks we are considering. Dorit? Right.
So those boxes down there equals be larger than 1. You know that they're counterexample. So this is the statement is that this holds for the typical system?
Right. So that's right. So very good. So I'm not this in the tensor network business, we are not interested in proving, well, we don't know how to prove things. We would be interested in proving, making statements that we can prove. But the question is, we have a large class of ground states of gap systems that obey the area law, and we have a large class of ground states of gapless systems which have this logarithmic violation. Okay? And we would be interested in efficiently representing those.
Okay, so, but for gapless systems, so there's, okay, I'm completely with you with not wanting to rigorously prove things that are very, very hard to prove, but there are things that we know that probably will not be able to prove, and this is that gapless systems always have nice behavior and that they're always sort of efficiently describable. That is probably not going to be proven.
No. All I'm saying here is that, are you talking about 1D or 2D or?
Even 1D.
In 1D, what we see.
We do know QMA hardness in 1D, right?
In 1D, what we see is that if you have a ground state of a Hamiltonian that represents some phase, some system, some physical system that has a quantum field theory description at short and long distances, then we know for that type of systems, a quantum critical system that has a CFT description at long distances, we know that there is a logarithmic scaling of entanglement entropy.
Yeah, okay, so under those conditions, not for any gapless system.
Yes, that's right. So maybe I should have specified this, and I'll make it clear now that I don't assume that all possible ground states of all, you know, fine-tuned Hamiltonians that you could consider will obey this scaling, either area law or logarithmic violation. I'm interested in what happens in systems that were studied before quantum information kicked in, right? So I'm going to call them natural systems, and there is a very large class of such systems, and if we succeed at simulating those, we'll be very happy. And whether that exhausts all possible ground states that you can obtain by fine-tuning Hamiltonians for the explicit purpose of violating those scalings, this is not a priority at this point, to be able to simulate fine-tuned ground states of extremely fine-tuned Hamiltonians. Okay. Good. So what I would like to do now is to go to two dimensions. And in two dimensions, in the sense that I just expressed, roughly speaking, what we see is that gap systems have ground states that obey the area law. And then there is a large class of gapless systems in two dimensions that still obey the area law. But there is also a large class of systems that have a logarithmic correction to the area law. Okay? And if you know about free fermion systems, you will see, well, you should think of these as systems that have a Fermi surface of dimension one, whereas the systems in two dimensions that obey an area law that are gapless could be systems with a finite number of Dirac points in the spectrum. So if you have a finite number of zero modes in two dimensions, then you still have an area law. If you have the number of zero modes itself, the zero modes form a dimension one manifold, then you have a logarithmic correction. Okay? And for gap systems, at least for in the case of free fermions, we would see that gap systems obey the area law. And we believe that roughly, this classification is applies to many, many systems of interest in condensed matter. And there is plenty of evidence for that. Okay? And again, if you think very hard, you might be able to build a Hamiltonian that violates this, that has a different scaling. But we're not going to be worried about those today. Okay, so our goal would be to find tensor networks for these guys here in two dimensions, and now I'm just going to accelerate a little bit. So a way you can generalize the matrix product state into two dimensions is, well, instead of connecting the tensors in just one dimension, connect them into two dimensions. So again, we have this physical geometry, which is the two-dimensional lattice, and we propose, you can attempt to describe wave functions by a tensor network which just reproduces this physical geometry. You put your tensors into a two-dimensional array, Is this an efficient representation? Well, you know the answer by now. You look at those tensors, they have Born indices and a physical index. Now we have four Born indices, but still this, if the Born indices have some number of values, which is chi, which is 10 or whatever, some fixed number, then each tensor has some finite number of parameters independent of the system size, and therefore the total number of parameters you need to specify the tensor network is just proportional to the number of tensors, which is n. Okay? So n spins require n order n parameters in this case. Good. We have an efficient manipulation. Can we compute the norm of this object, of this wave function? That's where it gets a bit tricky, because we have to take this wave function for the ket, for the brow, put it together, and we get our famous enemy, a two-dimensional tensor network, which is a number that we would like to extract, right, by contracting indices. But I already said before that there is no way to do this efficiently. Okay? So if we try to efficiently extract information from a PEPS by computing, say, the norm, if we just try to normalize the wave function in the first place, the cost is exponential in the smallest of these directions. Okay? So that's bad for business, except that this is just telling us that PEPS maybe is a variational class that is capable of encoding more than just the ground state that we're interested in. That's what is actually happening. If you use a PEPS to represent a ground state, it so happens that typically you find approximate schemes to contract this tensor network. Okay? And these approximate schemes are again efficient. So it turns out that if you try to use these approximate schemes for an arbitrary choice of variational parameters, this may not work at all. It may give you a very bad approximation. But there is the observation over the years that when you're trying to represent wave functions, ground states, of two-dimensional systems using this structure, when you try to contract this tensor network, you can find an efficient approximate way of doing it. Okay? So why do we care about, or what type of structural properties we could see here? Well, an area of an entanglement entropy. It follows, again, from the way we connected the tensors. Let's think about that. So imagine you are interested in a region of linear size L, so L times L. Automatically, you realize that in order to split the wave function into two pieces, one referring to the region and one for the rest, you have to break a number of indices, which is proportional to the boundary of the region. That's the area law, right there. Okay? So PEPS in two dimensions, but also in three and four, you can imagine doing this in higher dimensions, will always reproduce an area law just by construction. Entanglement entropy in MIRA, and this is where I need to keep checking, okay. In one dimension, we said that there was a logarithmic, well, I mentioned that there was a logarithmic correction because the number of indices you have to cut in order to split this part of the system from the rest that I didn't draw is logarithmic in the size of A. It turns out that the way it works is that you have contributions from L different length, log L different length scales. Each contribution demands, or each from each scale that you have here, you have to break one bond or two bonds per length scale. And so if you have log L length scales, you do the math, and you get that the number of indices that you have to cut indeed is logarithmic in L. We could repeat the same in two dimensions, so I didn't draw the mirror in two dimensions because it's very complicated, but what I have to discuss briefly can be done without drawing the two-dimensional tensor network. Just imagine this, where now on the basis we have two dimensions and you build some structure on top. So you have a three-dimensional geometry where the extra dimension corresponds to scale. In that case, when you try to split the wave function, you know, this plane represents the physical lattice in two dimensions, and the tensor network goes in an extra dimension. When we have a region A, and we want to split the tensor network into two pieces, one containing the region A and the rest, you have to break it by finding some minimal surface where you cut the smallest number of indices. And in that case, what you realize is that, again, there are contributions, local contributions. You have to cut a number of indices that this number of indices come These indices come from different length scales, but the number of indices that each length scale is contributing depends on the length scale. In this case, the first length scale contributes order L indices, the next one L over 2, the next one L over 4, and so by the time you've seen this sum before, right, when you sum L plus L over 2 plus L over 4 and so on, you end up with a number, total number of indices that you have to cut to split the tensor network into these two pieces is this time still proportional to L. So we have an area law, okay? Meta has an area law. If this was too fast, maybe there will be time this afternoon to discuss it. So what we have in our table is that in two dimensions and higher, this argument goes over to higher dimensions, we have that for gap systems, we could use a PEPS. For gapless systems, we could use a meta, but only for those systems that still obey the area law. And so a big question that we had for a while is, what do we do with logarithmic corrections in higher dimensions? Okay. And the answer came a couple of years ago with a more complicated tensor network called branching meta, which compares to meta in this way. If this is meta, you know, I've deformed meta in a little bit, but this is a way of representing meta. Then branching meta, what it's going to do is going to contain more tensors in such a way that at each layer we keep all degrees of freedom alive. So in meta, you could see that the number of degrees of freedom that we had was being reduced. L sites, L over 2, L over 4, and so on. Here, we just have that we go from L sites, or let's suppose this is N sites, lattice of N sites. We split it into two sublattices, each one containing N over 2 sites. So this tensor network extends in an extra dimension, and there is some geometry here, which is no longer hyperbolic. It's some strange geometry, which may have a characterization in terms of what's called sol geometries, but I'm not going to go there, which keeps all the degrees of freedom involved. And the point of doing that is that actually, because there are more degrees of freedom involved at all length scales, you can do this in an extreme case, which would be meta, just keep one leg of this tree, or you could keep all legs of the tree alive, or you could do something in between. And depending on the choices, you will have more or less contributions to the entanglement entropy coming from different length scales. And it's in such a way that in one dimension, you can go all the way from log corrections to volume law in one dimension, okay? So we have an efficient way, actually, of representing wave functions in one dimension that obey a volume law, not just the area law, or not just a logarithmic correction. We can efficiently represent and efficiently compute, okay? So that's a intriguing structure. We have not understood what it is useful for in general, but when applied in two dimensions or in dimensions larger than one, it allows us to reproduce the logarithmic correction, which is what I wanted to mention here. Okay, we have some more complicated structure that goes beyond meta that we call branching meta, which allows us to account for these logarithmic corrections. And so the picture then, we complete this picture, where for each type of typical scaling of entanglement that we observe in ground states of local Hamiltonians, we have the corresponding tensor network. Very good. And now I have to look at the clock. Yeah. And it's about time to finish, so I'm not going to go into this last piece, but that's okay, because there will be a focus lecture this afternoon that was just going to discuss some of these aspects. So thank you.
Yeah, I would like to take a few questions.
For branching meta, do we have an efficient way of contracting to find correlation functions and so on?
Yes. Thanks. So the merits of this construction are that you can efficiently manipulate still the tensor network and compute anything, any local observable.
Great.
Quantitative about how good an approximation to the ground state of some specific system, tensor network, say one dimension, MERA or other tensor networks have given.
So the question was that for a specific system, how can you quantify how good this approximation is, the ansatz is?
Okay, so let's see. The answer is that we have this bond dimension that I've been calling chi, which parametrizes how large the tensors are. And this is our refinement parameter. The larger chi is, the more variational parameters we use, the better the approximation is going to be. And so the answer is that it really depends on what you want to compute. If you are interested in the expectation value of local observables, they typically, in matrix product states, they improve exponentially with the bond dimension. So there is, if in cases where we know the exact solution, we can compare the numerical solution with the exact one, and we see that as we increase the bond dimension, we get closer and closer to the exact solution exponentially fast with the bond dimension for gap systems. Okay. For Meta, we will be talking about how well we approximate the scaling dimensions of a CFT, and that we know that we approximate them better and better as we increase the bond dimension, but we don't understand the scaling in a clear way. So we can refine. This is good news. We can refine our, the more computational resources you are willing to spend, the better the approximation that we're getting.
Can you say something about the situation on PEPs? You said that the approximate, for typical systems, the approximation is usually efficient. So is there any system, for example, for which this is not known, or not contrived systems, but a physical system?
So the you have a microphone, good. So I don't need to repeat the question. You could actually correct me if I said this wrong, but I think that the statement is that you could encode answers to NP-complete problems in PEPs. So if you can efficiently contract PEPs, then you would be able to collapse complexity classes, and that would be unexpected.
Yeah, that's right.
So the statement then is that we know that in general we should not be able to efficiently contract this tensor network. But then what we observe in practice is that if you are trying to approximate the ground state of a local Hamiltonian which obeys the area law, quite typically, what you have to do is you have to use tensor network techniques to contract this tensor network. In particular, you could use a matrix product state to contract from left to right this two-dimensional tensor network by, in one dimension, we had this situation where you just not need to progress from left to right by a vector that is being multiplied by a matrix. Now we use a matrix product state to be multiplied by a transfer matrix, which is a matrix product operator, whatever. There is a tensor network generalization of the matrix vector multiplication. And at each step, you have to truncate the bond index of this auxiliary matrix product state. And the observation is that when you do that for PEPs that represent ground states of local Hamiltonians, quite often there is convergence of, the more resources you spend in this boundary auxiliary matrix product state, the better the results look. There is convergence with respect to that bond dimension for the auxiliary matrix product state.
And is there any situation in which this is not known for an interesting physical case?
Every time you find an interesting problem that you want to solve with PEPs, so quite often what you find is that the computational resources you can afford, the bond dimensions that you can afford, do not give you yet an accurate solution. Right? So at least for, what we define challenging problems by through this, the problems that we have, for which we have that the current bond dimensions we can afford are not enough to get an accurate solution. But this is not a scaling with the system size. It's a scaling with the bond dimension.
I was wondering, do you have any physical insights why the ground states of so many systems lies in the subspace of the Hilbert space? I mean, this is a basis of these tensor networks, too.
Are you asking whether I know why there is an area law for ground states? In general, I don't know. Maybe the intuition is that you have a local Hamiltonian, and you're asking what's the wave function that has the smallest, the lowest energy by this Hamiltonian, the lowest eigenvalue by this Hamiltonian. So locality, imagine that you had a lot of entanglement. Okay? Then you look at local reduced density matrices on, say, one or two sides, and they will be proportional to the identity. Right? If you have a very entangled, if you pick up a generic state in the Hilbert space, which obeys the volume law, generically, when you look at the reduced density matrix for, say, two sides, it's going to be the identity, proportional to the identity. Right? But the energy minimization, the energy of the state is just the sum of expectation values. You know, the Hamiltonian is local, say it's two body terms. If you try to, if you look at the expectation value of the energy, it's the sum of expectation values for evaluated on reduced density matrices for two sides, right? It's the Hamiltonian is sum of local terms. You look at the, each local term, say it's a two-side local term. The expectation value for that is the trace with the reduced density matrix on those two sides. So in the end, all that matters when you compute the energy is the reduced density matrix on two sides. If this reduced density matrix is the identity, because you have a lot of entanglement in the wave function, then what you get is that you are taking the trace. You know, the trace of rho H12 is equal, if rho is the identity, it's just the trace of H12. So entangled states with a lot of entanglement are not good to minimize expectation values. They just give you the average energy for the Hamiltonian. They don't give you an extreme lowest eigenvalue for the Hamiltonian. So there is the understanding that the only way that, that you need to go away from this, this volume law in order to minimize the energy for a local Hamiltonian. And it seems that the area law is a typical way of accomplishing that.
Okay, thank you. So in view of time, I suggest that the rest of the questions should be discussed during the break. So let's thank Agrifer again.